This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to episode 154. I'm Chris Stafford. And on this week's episode, we're going to be hearing from a regular contributor to the podcast, the USEF Senior Dressage Judge Marilyn Heath, to tell us how much collection is needed to ride the second level. And later on in the program, we'll be having part two of the four-part series by Coralie Hughes on helping your horse perform its best. And we'll be hearing first from Jodie Swimmer from Louisville, Kentucky, who's going to tell us about her recent successes in training and competing with saddlebreds in dressage. But first, a reminder that the views of guests and the host of this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the USDF or its members. We do have just one item of news for you this week, though, that the schedule for the 2018 FEI World Equestrian Games that will take place in Tryon, North Carolina, and that is available on their website at tryon2018.com, tryon2018.com. And for those of you who are planning to attend the dressage competitions, they will be held from September the 12th through the 14th. We will, of course, keep you posted here on the podcast with any information regarding the 2018 FEI World Equestrian Games, so stay tuned right here on the USDF's official podcast. Our first guest is saddlebred rider and trainer from Louisville, Kentucky, Jodie Swimmer. Jodie recently realized one of her ambitions when she took part in the US Dressage Finals last year. An avid proponent of the breed, Jodie grew up with saddlebreds, and she explains through her own experiences why saddlebreds are so well adapted for dressage. Jodie, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's talk a little bit to start off with about your training establishment there and your involvement, because you do have a full-time job as well as enjoying your saddlebreds, don't you? So tell us a little bit about your situation there in Louisville.
Certainly. I'm a transplant from Charlotte, North Carolina. I was born and raised there. My parents, Marilyn and Harry Swimmer, still live on their farm where they raise saddlebreds. And I'm proud to say that my father is still involved in horses and a therapeutic riding program. I moved to Kentucky, oh gosh, in probably 1983. Long story short, let's just say it was for the horses. And I've made this my home since then. And I rode and campaigned my parents' horses that they raised on the farm until about 1995. And then our last horse was sold, and that's when I transitioned into dressage.
So you started very young with them, didn't you? Because they bred saddlebreds. And so saddlebreds go way back to your childhood, don't they?
Yes, yes. Mother, there are pictures of me in lead line as a two-year-old. So 55 years ago, I was literally raised on the back of a horse. And my mother, I didn't take very well to ballet, and I could tumble a little bit, but horses were definitely my thing my whole life. When I was, I think, around 10 years old, Mom and Dad bought 20 acres. And so we had our horses on our own farm from a young child. And Mother and Dad raised saddlebreds. And well, when I moved out to Kentucky, then I started campaigning them in saddle seat. Fran Crumpler was my saddle seat trainer my whole life.
Absolutely. And you did do other things as well. Didn't you do some English and Western pleasure and had a go at endurance as well? So you've done a little bit of other things, but how did you actually transition from those other equestrian sports to dressage then, Jodie?
Well, when I turned 40, I had some life goals, and I had campaigned the last horse that we had raised on the farm, and I really missed that daily interaction with my horse. And when you're in a saddle seat training barn, you don't necessarily get that. It's a different structure. And so we had a horse off the farm that we had raised, and he wasn't making it in saddle seat world, but I was bound and determined not to let him just get put on the truck, so to speak. Well, he was a naturally gated horse, so he didn't make it in dressage because he had a lot of difficulty in his canter and walk. But I did place him with a lovely barn, and Rob and Sarah Byers here in Kentucky. So after that, that horse didn't work out. We didn't have any other horses on the farm. So I bought my first dressage horse, a thoroughbred Hanoverian cross, a mare. And we got through second level. And then she got stuck, and I'm not very good at selling horses, and so I took her back to the farm, and Crystal Hoffman was helping me at that time. I finally, it was a steep learning curve, the transition from saddle seat to dressage, in that finding the right coaching and the right saddle, and, you know, it's a very steep learning curve. Anyway, I finally connected with Krista, and we did the best we could for the mare, and I refused a sale on her, and I took her back to mom and dad's, and that's where she lived her life out. And then after that, I kept looking for my next mount, and I had a for, you know, a budget for a horse, but I couldn't find one that fit what I wanted. And so I got scared one day trying out a warm blood, and I thought, you know what? Saddlebreds never act this way. In my 50-some years, I have never been afraid on a saddlebred. I've never had a saddlebred say, no, get off me. And my husband even said, you remarked, I've never heard you say you were afraid on a horse. And that was my light bulb moment when I said, you know what, I'm looking for a saddlebred. So that's what I started doing. I started just looking for a young horse to start.
And you found New York City Slicker, or George as you called him, as a two-year-old. Tell us about that meeting.
Well, Bill and Chris Knight, it's funny, I'd always watched Chris Knight work her own horses. She was an amateur, but I would watch her from afar just training her animals, and it was just a lovely picture. And I always thought if I ever had to buy a horse, I would want to buy one from Chris, because she's so kind and she's so correct and she's so gentle. And Bill actually called Krista, and Krista was like 9.5 months pregnant at the time. And he said, I've got a saddlebred I think we'll do dressage. And I had already been looking. So I said, sure, I'll go look. And it was just lovely. He was just a cute little colt standing in the stall, calm as he could be. And they brought him out, and they knew I had been was going to come out and look at him. So for that week, they had been trying to, quote, ride him long and low. And he had only been in the stall. You know, they just brought him in from the field for like maybe 20 days or so. And so, you know, he was trying real hard to understand what the gentleman was asking of him. And I just said, pull his tack. Let me take a look at him without his tack on. And I just loved the way he moved. And they said, oh, get back on him. And I said, no, that's okay. He's done enough today. I like him enough to come back. And Bill said, just bring your tack and work him. You know, so he just let me come out and just start working him. And I put him in the long lines, and I was wowed. I was like, that's what I'm looking for. And so he just let me keep working him. And I said, you know, he's got a canter under saddle or I can't buy him. And he did, you know, he's just such a quick study. He, you know, of course it was a baby canter, but he could canter. It was a good bounding canter.
Let's talk about his personality, and his, saddlebreds have a very good work ethic, don't they? I mean, they really do get down to it. And talk a little bit about his training and that work ethic, and why saddlebreds, you know, obviously are good at dressage, can do it, and why you championing the breed as you are in dressage.
Thank you. Like all the other saddlebreds I've ever had, they just explain it to me. They just want to understand what you want from them. Explain it clearly. So any faults in his training are from me, not from the horse, because I've never ridden a horse at this level, and I did all the training on him myself. Chris rode him for 3 months, and I've had, you know, when I had one surgery or another surgery, someone professional had ridden him for the total 3 months at a time total in his 12 years. So I can feel like I can credit myself for this, but he absolutely doesn't forget anything. He gets stiff. Okay, we all have a stiff side. You know, yes, he's got a stiff side and this, that, and the other, but he wants to understand. He wants to do for you. He's highly intelligent. He's one of the smartest horses I've ever had, but they're all smart. They just have their different skill sets. And this horse, definitely, when Bill said, I think I've got a horse that will do dressage, mark my words, he was right. Because the saddlebred is willing, intelligent. They're built upright. They want to collect, go to the bit, they'll go to contact. They want to learn. I had one German trainer one time tell me, he's a saddlebred. Teach him tricks. They do tricks. I'm like, well, yeah, but, you know, he does love his tricks. But, and he will try to outthink you because he's that smart. You have to ride every step. But, I mean, you know, that's riding. So There's no other breed for me. Absolutely not. And I am on a soapbox.
Right. And they are somewhat affordable compared maybe to the European Warm Blood, though, Jody.
Oh my gosh, yes.
So that's really, you know, something that would be attract maybe a lot of amateur adult riders. What should they look for, though, if they're going out shopping for a saddlebred? What kind of attributes should they look for, and what should they avoid?
Well, honestly, I think that, really realistically, you're not going to find a 3 or 4 year old saddlebred that's a clean slate. So you're going to have to look for a 2 year old that isn't fitting the bill or has been only green broke. And you're looking for, of course, a horse that's built in thirds. In terms of a saddle horse, some of the saddlebreds' necks come straight up. The gene for lordosis has been identified in horses. And of course, a lot of the saddlebreds do carry the lordosis gene. So you definitely want to look for a nice straight back. And with any horse, you want to find a nice round croup and articulation in the hock. George actually has a flat croup and straight hocks, but he is absolutely capable of sitting and coming through. It just takes a little more effort. So when you're looking at these young horses, you want to look at your conformation and look at their feet and look at their eyes and look at their tail and dock and all the same things you would look for with any breed or any horse and what appeals to you. But in particular with the saddle horses, it's important, I think, to talk to the local breeders and trainers and people in your region that breed saddlebreds and let them know you're looking for a prospect, because the what we're looking for, a more probably a straighter neck, and more reaching out of the shoulder is maybe something they don't really want to work with as much. But definitely in the $5,000 to $10,000 range or really less, sometimes even free, because some breeders want to do the right thing for the horses, so they're wanting them to have a good home. So you have some leverage there sometimes.
And what about temperament? What are the typical characteristics that you found with saddlebreds that would endear you, that those that are coming into the breed for the first time should look for? Some of the personality traits you find are typical with saddlebreds.
Well, when this colt was in the stall and I went out for the first time, that the groom that was handling him said, "Oh, he's a nice horse." I said, "Yeah." I said, "Can you pick his feet up?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Show me." I said, "Can you go all around him?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Show me." I said, "Can you grow under this horse? I want to know. I'm an amateur, and I want to make sure that this horse is not going to be spooky or crazy or sound." And so, with every horse that I look, I have a checklist of things I want to know. If you're buying a young horse from a reputable trainer or breeder, they've already imprinted the horse. They've already handled the horse. They're touching them. They're teaching them to do all the basic things, which may actually be done a little younger than maybe some other type situations. I don't know. I'm not as familiar with other breeds, but with the saddle horse breeders, they're making sure they're well handled because, nobody wants to work with a horse that doesn't understand what you want from them. But they're not crazy horses. They bred crazy out of the saddlebred. And that's my best answer and analogy to, the temperament of a saddlebred, is that they are very, very, very kind, loving animals as a whole, in my experience in 57 years.
And clearly very trainable. You've brought George up through the levels, haven't you? He seems to have made you even more competitive, more ambitious as you've gone up through the levels with him. And I know that you just want to keep going. I mean, obviously the US Dressage Finals was a milestone for you and probably a career highlight, making it to the I1 Finals there. What's next for him? Has he made you more competitive, more ambitious? Do you have a bucket list for him now?
I always said it, getting my silver was my goal, and everything else was icing on the cake. But yes, I wanted to go to Grand Prix. I wanted him to be another Grand Prix saddlebred, amateur owned and trained. And it was, it's a lot of work going to horse shows, and I do work full time and have a husband and all that good stuff. So yes, I think that all this has just absolutely met my goals. And you're interviewing me, and the breed's going to be honored in the USDF Connection next month, and it's just so wonderful. But I'm going to go to I1 this year at Nationals, by golly, and I'm going to earn a daggone ribbon. So that's my goal for this year.
Wonderful. Well, between now and the finals then, Jody, what's on your competition schedule for him? What next?
Very light. I just have one more score to qualify him for regionals, and we're really working hard on our PF massage and one piece. So I really don't want to campaign him hard this year. I'm working on I2 Grand Prix, and that's really my ultimate goal. And
well, you've given us an overview of some of the things to look for when training a saddlebred for dressage, though, Jody. Can you give us two or three tips about what to look for if you're going to actually get into training them? Some tips for our listeners who might be persuaded by you after this interview to get their first saddlebred.
Well, they typically are very light in the contact, so just encourage the lightness, but pushing through from back to front, just as you would with any horse. Do a lot of hacking, getting them comfortable with going out and, hill work. I don't think that the training is any different for a saddlebred than any other dressage horse. They may have a little bit of a longer neck and a little bit different in their withers, but it shouldn't matter in terms of what you do. You're still riding from inside leg to outside rein, and you're still riding back front and, asking them to be between two reins and two legs and enjoy your horse. I don't expect them to have any fear, so we just don't have fears. And again, for me, horses are forever. I don't sell horses, so I want to make sure that we have a right match, and I just encourage you to work with someone that will allow that to happen for you.
Well, you're obviously having a lot of fun with George, and lots more to come with your partnership with him. We want to wish you the very best of luck, Jody, and thank you very much indeed for taking the time to come on the program.
Thank you so much, Chris, for asking me, and it's been such an honor, and I truly appreciate it.
And as Jody mentioned there, she will be featured in the May edition of the USDF Connection magazine. And next, our regular contributor to the podcast, Marilyn Heath, who is an L program faculty member and a USEF senior dressage judge, is here to answer the frequently asked question about how much collection is needed to ride second level. Hi, Marilyn. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's nice to be here.
Well, we're going to talk about a subject I think that's dear to your heart in the judging world. How much collection is needed for second level? And it coincides, we should add, with an article that you've written for the USDF's Connection magazine. So where would you like to start with this topic?
Well, I could answer that question with one sentence, but I think that it is a subject that is worthy of a fuller explanation. And we'll get to that one sentence, but let's start out with some of the basics first. When studying the pyramid of training, we find that collection is the very top or the last building block on the pyramid of training. So then you ask, well, the top of the pinnacle of dressage is Grand Prix, so we don't need collection until Grand Prix? Well, no. We need some collection starting at second level. And we say, why second level? Well, the movements that are required at second level can only be done correctly with a little bit of collection. So you need enough collection to do the movements of the second level. At the same time, the movements of second level are the things that produce collection. So now isn't that confusing? So what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Well, they go hand in hand. So you need to have collection to get shoulder in, but shoulder in is one of the very best exercises to produce it. But let's start out by saying what is collection and what it is not. And so in order to define those things, we have two resources. We have the glossary and we have the USEF rulebook. The USDF glossary states that at trot and canter, it's a pace with shorter steps and a more uphill balance than in the working paces without any sacrifice of impulsion. So the horse's frame will be shorter with the neck stretched and arched upward. And I think what so many people do is they say, oh, I need to collect my horse, and so they think primarily of their hands to collect instead of thinking of their seat and legs, because in order to collect, the horse needs to engage. The horse needs to step a little more underneath the center of gravity and bend the joints of the hind leg while that leg is on the ground, in the grounded phase of the stride. So engagement is the amount of bend in the joints of the hind leg during the grounded phase. So you need to engage the horse, and then that brings the hindquarters lower, and in relation to the forehand is higher. But there's more to it than that we have discovered with our modern biomechanical knowledge. And that is that the forehand is part of the engaging process as well. So it's not just a matter of engaging the hindquarters to make it appear that the forehand is raised. It's actually engaging the muscles of the thoracic sling, which is the muscles around the withers shoulder area, a circle area around the withers and shoulder that would correspond to a collarbone in people, in other animals that have collarbones. Horses don't have collarbones. And so they have this thoracic sling, it's called, that supports the front end of the horse. And you can actually see the withers raise as the thoracic sling is engaged. So it's the hindquarters engaging, it's the thoracic sling engaging that gives the horse the appearance of being uphill. And so at second level, we want the horse to have an uphill tendency. At training level, we say the horse's balance should be level. At second level, the horse should be in the beginning of an uphill balance. And it's difficult for a horse that is just developing to produce the strength to be able to carry himself that way consistently. So we don't expect it to be as good as it is as the horse moves on up through the levels. I referred to the pyramid of training, and I'd like to go a little bit into detail there just to say that the trainer works constantly from day one. From the first day they ever get on the back of the horse, the rider or trainer is working to get the horse to go freely forward with a clear rhythm, with a steady tempo, accepting contact with the bit, with energy, to be straight and balanced. Well, now, okay, so straightness is the next to the last rung on the ladder. But from day one, we're working to make the horse straight. So the elements of the training scale are intertwined, and from day one, you're working to produce them all. So you have to understand that you don't work for rhythm on the first rung and then forget that and then move on and work for relaxation and suppleness and then forget that and work for connection or contact and then forget that and work on straightness and then forget that and work on collection. It's all intertwined, and each level builds on the level before. So what collection is not, it's not achieved by shortening of the gait. It's not achieved through an action of the hand, but by using the seat and legs to engage the hindquarters and activate the engagement of the thoracic sling. So as you can see, the rule book is more than a statement of rules, and please, I want everybody to think about using their USEF rulebook, the dressage section, and the glossary as textbooks. It's designed to be a textbook for the training of your horse, and it describes every level. It describes the purpose of each level. It describes the criteria and purpose of each movement, and the glossary is a resource which helps riders, trainers, and judges all to be on the same page, no pun intended. but that way, when a judge writes something on the sheet and the writer doesn't understand, you can go to the glossary and look up that word. Needs more collection, we'll go look it up, and then you'll see what that word really means. Each movement is judged on the basics. We teach a methodology for judging, for judges to arrive at consistent scores throughout the day, throughout the ride, throughout the class, throughout the day, throughout the weekend, throughout. And each movement is judged on the basics according to the training scale. And the judge evaluates whether the horse is fulfilling the requirements of each level. So the really important thing is for riders not to show their horse at a level above where the basics are correct. It's a disservice to the horse to show a horse at second level that is, does not have the necessary balance and self-carriage to enable it to do the movements of the second level with ease. Judges like to have a happy horse. Judges like to see a happy horse. And a horse that is struggling to do the movements of the level does not come across as a happy horse, and it lacks harmony. So when you're thinking of going to the second level, you need to think, is the horse more engaged than at first level? Is the horse in at the beginning of an uphill balance? And is the horse showing the impulsion required for the level? Is there a willing cooperation between the horse and the rider? Is the horse reliably on the bit? And is he in self-carriage appropriate to the level? So it all comes back to the basics. If the rider follows the purpose of the levels at each level, training level, and then builds on that fulfills the purpose of first level, and then builds on that to fulfill the purpose of second level, the results will be very favorable. Judges love to reward good riding, good training. If the rider observes these thoughts, everybody will be happy. The rider will be happy, the horse will be happy, and the judge will be happy.
Well, that's sound advice there, Marilyn. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the program and sharing that with us, and a reminder that you can read that in more detail in the USDF's Connection magazine. Marilyn, thank you very much indeed for your time again. Always good to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
And finally, in our education segment, we continue our four-part series that was recorded at the 2016 Attaquan USDF Annual Convention, in which certified practitioner of the Masterson Method of Performance Equine Bodywork, Coralie Hughes, talks about the importance of the muscular system of the horse.
60% of the horse's weight is in soft tissue, primarily muscles. Anything that the bones do, the muscles determine what they do. Everything is controlled by the muscles. In the words of the late Dr. Carey Ridgway, the muscles are the forgotten system in veterinary medicine. And that, for example, because of the way it's organized with, you have all the muscles acting through a tendon on a bone, and then you have ligaments stabilizing the joint, then if the muscles get tighter and tighter and tighter, then you get too much tension on a tendon, which torques the joint, which impacts the ligaments. And so in the words of Dr. Ridgway, the strained suspensory is actually the symptom. The cause is in the muscles, barring any kind of traumatic injury. So it's really important to have a sense of what's going on in the muscles, because they drive everything. And muscles usually get tight in an unbalanced way, which means uneven pressure on parts of the skeleton. So a little bit on how muscles work. Muscles can only contract and relax. They can't really stretch. They can contract and relax, and so they work in pairs. So you always have contraction and relaxation that has to happen within a muscle and within the muscle pairs. Okay, so what happens over time with the muscles, just because they exist and they're doing work, and you know, just because they're horses or they're beings with muscles, it's just what happens to muscles over time. Say a muscle starts out being able to relax, contract, relax, contract, relax, contract. The muscle starts losing the ability to fully relax and fully contract. And when that happens, you start getting restriction of the joints, where you no longer have the reach that you used to have, because somewhere in that system something has lost the ability to fully relax or to fully contract because of an uneven and excessive negative tension. And when we talk about the pole being the highest point, it's basically C1, the atlas that we're talking about. And the muscles over the atlas, before I started doing this work, I thought I was feeling bone because it was always so hard. I didn't realize that it was an inch of muscle. It was an inch, solid inch of soft tissue over the top, which made me really feel bad for my horses and every other horse that I had anything to do with. So we have short muscles that govern the atlas and axis and the pole, because of how important that region is, because that's where the brain stem comes out. And then we have really long muscles that come from the skull all the way under the shoulder. And it's fascinating how what's going on in the shoulder affects what's going on in the pole. What's going on in the pole affects what's going on in the shoulder, because they're connected. Now, the muscles over the top line in a dressage horse, an upper-level dressage horse, get very highly developed, because they start taking work off of the back. And because the horse has to come up so much, we'll talk about how they do that in just a minute. But these muscles, especially this rhomboid here, get very highly developed. And we, of course, have all this stuff in our body. It's just more interesting for me to think about it in the horse. But the multifidi muscles are tiny little muscles that wrap around the axial spine, and they control every one of these vertebral junctions. Their job is to prevent overextension or overflexion anywhere. Problem is, they spasm when there's been something that's too much. They spasm, and then you lose mobility in that part of the horse. So you have giant muscles that get tight, and then you have these tiny muscles all the way along that spasm and get very tight and prevent the skeleton from moving. The brachiocephalicus, he goes from the head to the front leg. And that muscle does a lot of different things, but one of the things it does is pull the front leg forward. So the front leg coming forward is attached to the jaw. And so when a horse works really, especially a dressage horse, they're really working hard with those big shoulders coming forward, or they spend too much time in a big extended trot, it increases tension in the TMJ and the pole, and also down in the hyoid structures underneath. So there's a fascinating connection. Neurologically, anything that's going on in the pole is happening in the sacrum, and anything that's happening in the sacrum is happening in the pole. The long back muscle, it's on either side of the spine. The way this back muscle works is really important to understand for dressage, because it's on either side of the spine, but it's hooking to the top of these vertebral processes that we can feel sometimes on a horse. So when that muscle is too tight, we've all experienced a tight-backed horse, it pushes the spine down. And in dressage, what do we need? We need the spine coming up. And that's a very important concept about how this back muscle, if it's too tight, it works left side and right side. So if it contracts on the left side, it helps to bring the left leg forward. If it contracts on the right side, it helps to bring the right leg forward. So the way it works is left back, right back, and for the walk it's going to be a little different, but you get the idea of that coordination. Okay, so there's a structure that is just super important for dressage called the thoracic sling, and I had never heard of this before. The thoracic sling is the pectoral muscles that act as the shock absorber for the horse when the horse lands or every trot step. To get any suspension coming back up, it's the spring of the pectoral muscles protecting the rib cage, and then muscles underneath the scapula next to the rib cage that attach to the rib cage and bring it up. When a horse hunches his shoulders, which isn't what he's actually doing, his withers fall down between the posts of the two front legs. So when we do body work on a horse, the withers actually rise because I've released the thoracic sling, and which is what's required for the front of the horse to elevate for us. But muscle tension gets in there and the horse gets stuck on the forehand and they're stuck to the ground. Okay, so without the abdominal muscles, we could not ride a horse without destroying their back. Because the abdominal muscles in a correctly ridden horse, the abdominal muscles are like the string of a bow. If the back muscle can relax and lift up, it's lifted by the abdominal muscles contracting. And so then coming down to the back end, we talk about collection. Collection is really important to us. The psoas muscle is under the lumbar, hooks underneath the pelvis, and that muscle, we have one too, it picks our leg up, but in a horse, it brings that leg forward, but it tilts the pelvis. And so it's the pelvic tilt that is a big part of collection. And that's coming from relatively small muscle that does so much work, it spasms and gets very tight. And you see a permanently roached lumbar where the lumbar looks arched. That very often is because of a spasm in the lumbar, the muscles under the lumbar of the psoas. Okay, tensor fascia lata and the quadriceps, they bring the leg forward. The gluteus medius, the biceps, the biceps femoris, and then the hamstrings, they bring the leg back. But we talked about the muscles working as pairs, one relaxing and one contracting. They also work in systems. So when you're getting a short stride length, and you know where to look and think about the muscles that are inhibiting that stride length, it could be in the back, or it can be in the muscle structure around the haunches or in the shoulders. Oh, one last thing about the muscles. So the muscles work in pairs, one contracting, one relaxing. They work in systems with one group of muscles contracting and one group of muscles relaxing for it all, and it all has to stay in balance. And muscles also work in chains. So the dorsal chain, this is the chain that a wild horse uses all the time. Because what do they want to do? They see something, they just want to get out of town. So those are the extensor muscles. They're the galloping muscles. And they push the back down, which is fine for a horse in the wild. It doesn't work for a ridden horse. But we also have the ventral muscle chain. Two chains have to work together in sync, so you have a back that you can use. You can have engagement from the hind end. You can have elevation of the front end. And so that gives you a circle of muscles that's in balance and is healthy for the horse to do their work for you. So a little bit about biomechanics of dressage, and then we'll get into some of the issues and what causes excessive negative tension. Biomechanics, we already talked about that what pulls the leg forward, the muscles that pull the front leg forward and the muscles that pull the front leg back, and the muscles that pull the hind leg forward and the muscles that pull the hind leg back. Bend is probably more important in dressage than most other disciplines. I think we could all agree with that. And what all has to happen for even bend. We talk about straightness in a dressage horse, but we talk about straightness on a circle, which is the same amount of bend throughout the skeleton on a circle, right? Well, what actually has to happen in the horse for that to occur? Number one, you can't have too much bend in that flexible neck. That has to be controlled. But say we have a horse that's bending in my 10-meter circle. So the neck, that's not so bad. You control the neck. But the shoulders have to rotate. And if the thoracic sling is too tight, they can't. So the shoulders have to rotate. The back has to come around and match the bend of the circle. And so for the back to do that, the rib cage has to move out, which means the muscles on the inside of the rib get tighter. But they get looser on the outside of the rib cage. The entire trunk on the outside of the horse has to be very supple, the outside of the bend. For the haunches to do that, there has to be a tilt in the pelvis, and that's the inside leg coming in. And that tilts the pelvis, and then the horse can be straight on a circle. So the biomechanics of bend, there's a lot going on, a lot of moving parts that we're using. The purpose of collection is to make the horse maximally usable, so he's mobile. He's mobile in front. So the front end has to be free and has to come up. That's a free thoracic sling that can lift the horse up and lift the withers up. The back has a role in that because the back hooks into the lower cervical. When it contracts for collection, it elevates the front end as well in a lever kind of action. And so then we have the psoas and the abdominals tipping this pelvis. And when you tip that pelvis, then the leg can step under farther. If you can't tip the pelvis because of muscular restriction, the hind leg can't step under. So you can have differences in ability on the left or the right side for the hind leg to step under because of what's going on in the musculature of the back end. So that's the essence of the biomechanics of collection made really, really simple.
And in our next episode, Coralie will be back to explain about the biomechanics of the gaits and movements. And finally, a reminder, with just 2 weeks to go to this year's Rolex Kentucky 3-day event, which runs from the 27th through the 30th of April, be sure to stop by and visit the USDF's National Education Center when you're in the Kentucky Horse Park, because there you can visit the Rumor Foundation USDF Hall of Fame, as well as the Lendon F. Gray Bookstore, and also have the opportunity to meet our staff here at the USDF's National Education Center. And that's it for this week's episode. As always, we'd like to remind you that you can download this podcast from the iTunes podcast store to any podcast app, including Podbean or Stitcher. Be sure to visit us online at usdf.org for all the latest news and updates, as well as educational resources and information at eTrack. And also follow us on social media on Facebook and Twitter, where we also post the latest episode of the podcast. Until the next time, thank you for listening wherever you are in the world. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.